And welcome to week 21, Cain's Ark. I should note, that's all right. I don't need to note. I was going to say something, but we're not there yet. We are early in the chapter. We're talking about how God has fulfilled the promises made to the Jews via Shlomo's reign. And the first promise that we talked about was territorial expansion. Without ever waging war, as we noted last week, nonetheless, he is in control from the Euphrates all the way to the Mediterranean. That's the way it's described here. There's a lot of grain needed. There's a lot of meat needed. And what I want to do this week is to continue to show that with the fulfillment of two more divine promises in this opening part of chapter 5. And then we'll start on the wisdom of Solomon. And that's really, its own discussion. There's an awful lot going on there. The description is in chapter 5, even though the wisdom is given to him in chapter 3. And we'll have to talk about why the divide is there, why it's in two parts. But let's get underway. So if you take a look at chapter 5, sentences 4 and 5. We are told, I'm just turning pages in my own, the Dot Mikra edition has a lot of pictures and maps and whatnot. We are told in sentences 4 and 5, Ki hu rodeh b'chol eber hanahar, that Solomon reigns over the entire bank of the river. And when it says bank of the river, what we mean is the Euphrates, something that people often don't realize. When we talk about Avraham as Avraham ha'ivri, right, or as we say in the Haggadah, Be'ever Hanahar Yeshvu Avotechem Me'olam, we say that your ancestors lived by the bank of the river. Sometimes people are confused and they think that means the Jordan River. It does not. It refers to the Euphrates. That's where Abraham came from. So here we're told that Solomon ruled Bechol Ever Hanahar, that whole land on that side, the western side of the Euphrates, mi Tifsach ad Aza, from Tifsach to Aza. B'chol malchei eber hanahar, all of the kings on the side of the river, v'shalom hayalom mikol avarav saviv, and he had peace from all sides. That's sentence 4. And then sentence 5, v'yeshev Yehuda v'Yisrael lavetach, Judah and Israel. And again, Yehuda and Yisrael, they have these separate identities, even before there are separate kingdoms. They are sitting securely, living securely. Ish tachas gafno, v'sachas te'enaso. Each one under his grapevine, each one under his fig tree. Midan va'ad Be'er Sheva, from Dan in the north of Israel, to Be'er Sheva in the south. Kol yemei Shlomo. All through the life of Shlomo. Okay, so first of all, from Tifsach, by the bank of the river, to Aza. If you take a look at source number 1, very relevant with Purim coming up, Gemara in Megillah, Rav and Shmuel had a debate about Tifsach and Aza. Chad amar Tifsach b'sof ha'olam v'Aza b'sof ha'olam. One said what that means is that Shlomo controlled from Tifsach on one side of the world to Aza, the other side of the world. V'chad amar Tifsach v'Aza b'hadei hadadi avu kaimi, and the alternative view was that Tifsach and Aza were actually side by side. K'shem shamalach al Tifsach v'al Aza kach malach al kol ha'olam kulo. Just like he reigned easily over these two adjacent places, so he reigned everywhere. And the reason why I say that this is fitting with Purim coming up is because this is part of a Gemara that does the same thing with Mehodu v'ad Kush for Achashverosh. From India to Ethiopia, from Hodu to Kush, they have the same discussion of whether Hodu and Kush are side by side or not. Either way, the Gemara believes that Shlomo actually controls the whole world. Whether you take the view that they're side by side or not, Shlomo's reign is not just between the Euphrates and the Mediterranean, but it is everywhere. Do we know anything about Tifsach? We have two candidate locations for what Tifsach could be, and they actually fit, very interestingly, the two views brought here in the Gemara. Tifsach is only mentioned in this place right here, and then it comes up again in Malachim Bet, chapter 15, sentence 16, as a city conquered by Menachem, who was a king in the northern kingdom of Israel. But one candidate for what Tifsach is a city called Thapsacus. In source number 2, I brought you Wikipedia's explanation of Thapsacus. Thapsacus was an ancient town along the western bank of the Euphrates River that would now lie in modern Syria. This is on the bank of the Euphrates. Thapsacus was the Greek and Roman name for the town. The town was important and prosperous due to its river crossing, which allowed east-west traffic, and mentions Menachem conquering it as well. This is one view of where this is. They even point out the possibility that it may be linked to a place called Churbat Tafsa. That brings us to the second possibility, that it's a city that is 6 miles west of Shechem. That's a lot closer to Gaza. So you have the idea that either Tifsach is bank of the Euphrates, far from Gaza, which is right by the Mediterranean, or Tifsach is somewhere in the middle of Israel, 6 miles west of Shechem, not all that far from Gaza. So two different possibilities for where this place is. But in any case, I didn't want to get bogged down in it, but I didn't want to ignore it either. Shlomo reigns, certainly over the local area, as the Gemara believes Shlomo reigns everywhere, and it is a reign without war, as we noted last time. And I brought you the pasuk in source number 3, in which Hashem says to David, this is Hashem's promise, Bein nolad lach, you're going to have a son, Hu yiye ish menucha, he will be a man of rest. V'hanichosi lo mikol ayvav misaviv, I'm going to give him peace from all of his enemies around him. Ki Shlomo yiye shemo, his name will be Shlomo. Shalom, peace. V'shalom v'sheket etein al Yisrael b'yamav, and I will give peace over Israel in his day. So this is the fulfillment of promise number 2. Promise number 1 was territory, land. We started on that yesterday and continued that with Tifsach to Gaza. Promise number 2 that is fulfilled is the promise of peace. Along with that comes promise number 3. And that is the promise of plenty. We have been promised that we will have plenty when we are good. This was in Devarim chapter 28. Which I think we referenced last time. The image of being beneath your grapevine, beneath your fig tree, is a classic biblical image of plenty. And if you look at your sheet at source number 4, we're not looking up all of these psukim, but I gave you them there so that you can look up those psukim. The first line there is trying to show places in Tanakh where we are promised that in the future, each one will be beneath his fig tree, beneath his grapevine. You see it in Micha. Micha is middle to second part of the first temple period. Zechariah, who's the beginning of the second temple period. And in Shir HaShirim, which is credited to Shlomo. So it's an image of plenty. It's also an image of loss, as I put in the next line. Yeshaya uses it to describe the decay of the enemies of God, that they will not have this. Yirmiyahu uses it to describe what the enemy will consume of ours. Ditto Hosea, ditto Yoel. Warnings that the enemy will consume our fig tree. The enemy will take our grapevine. The Assyrians co-opted this image. That's the third line in source number 4. When the Assyrians warn the Jews of the northern kingdom that they're going to invade, and they say, don't worry about it, you're going to come with us. We are going to transfer you to a new land that's as good as your own. They say, you will each have your grapevine, you will each have your fig tree. So it's an image of plenty and prosperity. And it's a popular Christian image as a result, because they see it in Tanakh. So I gave you a reference to a paper in the end of source number 4. The Vine and Fig Tree in George Washington's Letters. You can find it online at that link. He liked the image of people being under their grapevine and under their fig tree as well. So that's the image here is an image of prosperity. So God has provided territorial expansion, peace, and prosperity for Shlomo's reign. Pausing here. Are we clear? Yes, Ricky.
I'm surprised to see the name of Azza, which is Gaza. It was already named Azza.
Oh, yeah. No, Azza shows up in Chumash. The Boachatzara ad Azza, in when the cities, when Sodom and its surrounding area are destroyed, Azza is, no, that can't be. That can't be. That would not be the same Azza. But the answer is yes. The city of Azza does show up very early on. You may recall, I think you were there, I'm not sure, when we did the end, towards the end of the book of Shoftim, of Judges, Shimshon, Samson, was in Azza. Azza is very old. It is also, I think, in Chumash. I'm just blanking for the moment. It's there.
Another thing, when it says from Dan to Beersheba, it's not such a long, and they're not close together. But I thought Solomon reigned all the way down to.
No, Dan and Beersheba are different places. Dan is way up north. Beersheba is in the south.
There's a big difference, but it's still, yes. Beersheba's not south enough, I mean.
Oh, that's what you mean. Right. So it's worth noting that biblical Israel did not extend all the way down to what we call Eilat today. There was a city of Eilat in biblical Israel, but it wasn't all the way down there by the water. The biblical Israel did not include the entirety of what we call the Negev today.
Didn't Solomon reign all the way down to Egypt? Why does it stop at Beersheba?
Didn't Solomon reign all the way down to... Oh, you mean that? Because he's describing here the plenty that they have in Israel. Right? If you go back to the sentence, yeah, it's talking about what Shlomo's people had directly. The Jews had their grapevine, their fig tree. These are the ones who observed the Torah. Where the description is that Shlomo controls all of these areas, including Egypt, which, you know, this area by the that we referenced last week, but it's not settled by Jews. It's still settled by Egyptians.
That's it also looks very poetic. The whole section here looks very poetic.
Yeah. First of all, Azza, I mean, the pasuk I'm remembering is there. I'm not going to stop the Zoom now to look it up, but Boacha Gerara Ad Azza is a pasuk. Yes. Susan, and then Bruria.
I was wondering, you said this, why did they pick Israel for the other tribes? Because, where did that, the word Yehuda we call by the name of the tribe.
Right.
There is no tribe, Israel.
Right, so keep in mind Israel is the name of Yaakov. And
right.
The Jews already, hang on, and the Jews already in Egypt are known as Am B'nai Yisrael. That's what Paro says. And when we come out, we identify that way. So since they were the bulk of the nation, they are Yisrael, and Yehuda, which is just one tribe, stands out as Yehuda.
Okay.
That's the idea. I will also note, just because I saw it just this week, and I'm going to be using it possibly in my shiur tonight. There's a chance for me to remind people about the birthday shiur this evening. The Chidushei Harim, who I think was the first or second Gera Rebbe, I should look that up before tonight, comments that Jews become known as Yehudim because we're supposed to have that trait of gratitude that Leah had when she named Yehuda. She said, Hapam odeh et Hashem, now I will thank God. So we are supposed to have that trait of being thankful. That's how we get the name Yehudim. But in terms of where they got Yisrael, it was because they were representing the nation that was were the descendants of Yaakov.
I always wondered that.
Sure. Okay. Bruria.
Yeah, I was wondering,
Yeah, I was just wondering, did the nations that Shlomo ruled over, do they pay taxes or any kind of, do they have to give anything to Shlomo? I'm just wondering about the wealth that...
So there was a definite exacting of what we would call in a catch-all phrase, mas. The reason I use the word mas is because the word mas can mean different things. It may include paying money. It may also include labor, that they had to send people to do different jobs, construction things or whatever for the country as a whole. We're going to see more of that when we talk about the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. So,
talking about?
Quite possibly.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay,
thanks. Mm-hmm. I saw the note in the chat from Margie, and yes, Shimshon ends up in Aza first in the beginning of chapter 16 in Shoftim, in Judges, when he's there with the Zonah in Aza, and then when the Plishtim capture him in the end of chapter 16, that's where he is in Aza. But it's earlier, it's in the Chumash as well. Okay. Now, inevitably, when you deal with Shlomo, things look great, and then suddenly they don't look great. And now we have to look at what's coming next in sentence 6. Vayihi l'Shlomo arba'im elef arvot susim lemerkavo. Shlomo had 40,000 arvot susim. I'm going to ask a couple of people here what their translations say. Susan, you have a translation there. What does your translation say? 40,000 what of horses?
It says, and Solomon had 40,000 stalls.
Stalls, okay. Good. Stalls of horses. That's one possible explanation for or vote. Who else do I know has a translation here? I think, Vanessa, you have a translation, right? No? You do not. Okay. Got it wrong. Joyce, you have the art scroll, right? What does it have in the art scroll?
I have the JPS and it also has stalls.
Stalls. Okay. That's funny. I didn't realize that you had that. All right. I'm guessing wrong. Who has the art scroll? Anyone? Nope. No art scrollers. Wow. Okay. So we will not. Oh, Ellen has it. Okay. You're going to have to unmute the...
Which pasuk is it? Because I'm in another Chumash too.
Oh, okay, yeah. Sentence 6.
Stables are stables. For his chariots.
Okay, stables. That fits with what we're going to see from the Gemara. Thank you. So 40,000 stalls or stables of horses for his chariots, and 12,000 parashim, which is usually understood to be charioteers. So there are a lot of things to talk about. First thing to talk about is direct problem with Divrei Hayamim Bet. If you take a look at source number 5, I gave you a pasuk that appears in Divrei Hayamim Bet chapter 9. Vayhi lishlomo. Shlomo had 4,000 4,000 uriot susim, uriot of horses. And again, I don't know what uriot are. If anyone's looking in their translation for Divrei Hayamim and can answer us, that would be great. Umarkavot, as well as chariots. Ushnemasar alaf parashim. Once again, 12,000 charioteers. So we've got the charioteers at least have a consistent number. They haven't shrunk. Fine. The rest of the pasuk doesn't matter so much for us. The problem is you got 40,000 orvot and 4,000 uriot. What in the world is going on? So there are a lot of answers. I did not want to take a lot of time on this issue, but you had to point it out. So if you take a look between 5 and 6, I gave you a table of 5 different views. First view, Gemara in Sanhedrin says that in Malachim, in our text, it's saying 40,000 rows, or troughs, and that may be stalls, inside each stable. And Divrei HaYamim is saying, and there are 4,000 stables. So in other words, he has 4,000 times 40,000 horses. That's one way to deal with it. That's a lot of horses. Then the Gemara brings you an alternative view. 40,000 stables, and each one had 4,000 rows or troughs of horses. Also a lot. Commentators post-Talmud take a different approach. But they all agree there's an awful lot of horses here. Ralbag suggests, and Abarbanel suggests, that it's 40,000 horses, 4,000 troughs. In other words, the term that we used here, urvot, is not the same thing as uriot. They're two different things. One is referring to the horses themselves, and one is referring to the troughs. Ralbag offers another answer, which is that here we're talking about the horses, and Divrei HaYamim is talking about the pairs of horses and chariots. That's 4,000. And then finally, one other view, I wrote Malachim in the table. That should say Malbim, I apologize. Got Malachim on the brain here. Malbim says it's not about different numbers of, multiples or whatever, it's about what he used them for. He had 40,000 horses for war. That's what we're talking about here. And he had 4,000 for personal use, as recorded in Divrei HaYamim. I am coming back to all of this in a little bit. I just want to first conclude this section and then come back to this number of horses. We got to deal with this because this is going to present a problem. But take a look at sentences 7 and 8 first. V'chilkelu ha-nitzavim ha-eila es ha-melech Shlomo. The Nitzavim, who we mentioned in chapter 4, these officers who feed Shlomo, they're supporting Shlomo. The Eis Kol HaKariv El Shulchan HaMelech Shlomo, and whoever comes to the table of King Shlomo, Ish Chodsho, each one his month, as we have already discussed. When we say, by the way, the people who come to the table of Shlomo, Abarbanel points out, that doesn't mean literally people eating at his table. It means they ate at tables in the palace, or they took food that he gave them and they ate it at their own tables. Don't imagine the table of Shlomo and thousands of people there, says Abarbanel. That's not the way it works. Lo ya'adru davar, not a thing is lacking. V'ha-se'orim v'ha-teven la-susim v'la-rachesh, and barley and straw for the horses and for the rachesh. There's another word with Purim coming up that's important to us. Megillat Esther, rochvei ha-rechesh. The rechesh are assumed to be fast horses. That's what it means. So you have the horses, and then you have the fast horses. Yaviyu al-makom asher yiyasham ish kemishpato. They brought them to the place where Shlomo was. Remember, Shlomo may be moving. That's what Abarbanel thinks. Each one according to whatever he needed. I already knew the Nitzavim were providing this. So Radak says, yeah, but here we're adding in that they're supporting the horses. Abarbanel says it's just a summary. We've mentioned all these different elements, the leaders, the people from other countries, the horses, so now we're just giving a summary. But now two notes on this overall section. First of all, worth thinking about. If you go back to sentence 1 in this chapter, chapter 5, sentence 1, where we started talking about all of this plenty, we said that Shlomo ruled in all of these lands from the river, the Euphrates, all the way to the land of the Plishtim, all the way to the boundary of Egypt. He's not controlling Egypt, he's controlling land there in Egypt. His father-in-law may have something to say about that. But the key is, they would send gifts and serve Shlomo kol yemei chayav, all of the days of Shlomo's life. These people are serving Shlomo. That's number one. Number two, in sentence 5, we are told that everybody is tranquil, everybody is prosperous, once again, kol yemei Shlomo, all through the time of Shlomo. And the problem with that is if you jump ahead to chapter 11, sentence 25, hopefully we will get there by the end, you find there that Shlomo gets in trouble. Shlomo is in trouble with Hashem, And Hashem appoints a satan, an opponent for Shlomo. And there it says that this person, who we're going to learn about eventually, God willing, becomes a satan for Israel kol yemei Shlomo, all the days of Shlomo. I don't understand. First you're telling me we're prosperous and peaceful all the days of Shlomo. But now you have an opponent who is a satan for Israel all the days of Shlomo. So how do I understand that? Abarbanel offers two answers. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Umasha amar kol yemei Shlomo, when it said all the days of Shlomo, eino soter l'mashi yomar achar zeh, that's not contradicting what it's going to say about Hashem setting up a satan for Shlomo and da-da-da, he's a satan for Israel all the days of Solomon. L'fisha kavana shamahi. Is that at the end of his life, when Shlomo was already aged, at that point, that's when these opponents, sotanim, arose. And then the rest of his life, they were sotanim. So in other words, all his life means all that was left of his life. That's one explanation. And since it was, and it, as he got older, so that means that that period of war was very small. And most of Shlomo's life was indeed tranquil. Like it says, he will have peace in his life. And here he says what I wanted you to see, which is that when it says all the days of Shlomo, it means most of the days of Shlomo. When you see all in the text, a declaration like that, don't assume it has to be 100%. It means most. Don't get hung up on it. That's Abarbanel. He's very laid back. He's very West Coast in his whole approach to things, Abarbanel. Okay, that was one point. Rose, I'm going to ask you to hold off because I want to talk horses. After the horses, we'll come back and talk about this whole section. But the horses are really, really important because what Shlomo is doing seems to be wrong. We've learned, I don't know how many times, this section in Devarim chapter 17, which gives the laws of the king. And one of the instructions is, Lo yarbe lo susim. He's not allowed to have many horses. That's no good. You're not allowed to have many horses, Shlomo. I think this qualifies as many horses. Look at the Mishnah. Source number 7, where the Mishnah asks, what exactly is the cap here on horses? Ela kidei merkavto, enough for his chariot. So if you ask me, if you have 40,000 horses, or stalls of horses, or stables of stalls of horses, or whatever it is, 40,000 something of horses, right? When you say that, and then you tell me you have only 12,000 charioteers, I can do the math. You have horses that don't have chariots. Like, what are you doing with this? What in the world is that about? So two different approaches are brought in the commentators. The first approach is to say, yes, Shlomo, you have a problem. And that's what Radak says. If you take a look at source number 8, he quotes you the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says explicitly, Shlomo was in violation of the law. The law says you're not allowed to have so many horses, and Shlomo had so many horses. Upirish lo yarbe lo susim bitelin. When it says you're not supposed to have too many horses, that means horses that are doing nothing. V'kevan shalo hayu lo ala 12,000 parashim, and since he had only 12,000 charioteers, v'hayu lo 40,000 or votes susim, and he's got 40,000 whatever they are of horses, rows, troughs, stalls, stables, harbe susim betelu hayu lo, he had lots of horses that were doing nothing. Uma shehir bashlamo susimu parashim, v'hu lo aysalo shum milchama, so why did he get all these horses? What was that about? Why, was it just gifts sent to him? Like, what? Why does Shlomo have all these horses without a war? Lo asa ela lechavod ugdula. He did it for stature, for honor. Whenever he travels, he's got a huge entourage of horses. And also, you should know, if you look in Divrei Hayamim, there are a couple of small wars that are mentioned, so he went to war sometimes. That's the statement of Radak, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara actually also brings a pasuk from chapter 10. I see your hand, Moshe, but I'm going to ask you to hang on. But that's one approach. And then the other approach is Abarbanel. And we have already found that Abarbanel is ever the defender of Shlomo. Right? Abarbanel came in to defend Shlomo when he married the daughter of Paro. Abarbanel is a defender in general of the Davidic line. You have to know that about him. So he says, it's not that he had too many horses. It's not true. He needed them to keep the peace. In the interests of time, I'm just going to read my translation, but you have the original Hebrew there. In truth, the number of horses is very large, Abarbanel acknowledges. I've never heard of any non-Jewish king. I have not seen in any of the chronicles of their early kings any king under the sun whose house always, in peacetime, without war or opponent or harm, had 40,000 horses unnecessarily, but only for honor and splendor to accompany him from place to place and run before him. He says, I never heard of a king that had this. And our sages already said that Shlomo transgressed, he shall not increase his horses with this, since they were not needed for war. That's the Gemara in Sanhedrin that Radak quoted. And I think Solomon did not see fit to increase these horses and charioteers for arrogance and haughtiness and exaltation and a bad path. He says, no, that's not why Shlomo had these horses, but rather as a reasonable plan. Because of this number of horses, the kings around him feared him and were humbled before him and sent him gifts, which they would not have done had they not known that he possessed so many chariots, charioteers, and horses such that he could conquer them at all. The point was to intimidate the neighborhood. Right? That's what he's trying to do. I think the Russians have learned a little bit that, you know, just because your army is large, that doesn't mean everyone's going to be intimidated. But that's the goal of having all of these horses, is in order to send a message to the local population. And it made more sense to do this, to invest in this for peace, than to wage war. I'm never going to have to fight if everybody is afraid. And I see Esther's notes in the chat about the nuclear weapon deterrent. I think Abarbanel, while not familiar with nuclear weapons, would say yes, that's exactly what's going on. So the Gemara says, Shlomo has too many horses. He is transgressing here, thinking that he knows better. Radak says he's doing it for the wrong reasons. Abarbanel says, yeah, but he's doing it for the right reasons. But the summary of our section that we've now seen at the end last time and then this time is Shlomo and the nation are prosperous. God is fulfilling past promises, territorial, in terms of peace, in terms of prosperity. But these horses may indicate that clouds are on the horizon. Not all is well in the land of Shlomo. Okay, I know there are questions and comments, so now's the time. Who do we have? Rose.
Okay. I just want to ask from the previous thing they talked about. All the days of Solomon, they're not going to, and God raised up a Satan against Solomon. And then they say Hadad of Edom.
Yes.
So we know that Edom is east, itself.
Yes.
Does this have significance, Hadad of Edom?
So we're going to have to get to him in chapter 11. We're not there yet. Yeah. Moish. You're muted.
There we go. Alright, there we go. Okay, there's 2 points that I want to make. First of all, the Daraisa, I'm really disappointed that the Gemara, because they really don't even look at the pasuk.
Yes, they do.
It says, Lo Yarbel, Lo Susim.
Yes.
On the simple, obvious understanding is, he can't do this for his own glory. Whatever he's doing for his military might, or whatever service, it's not a problem. So I don't understand the
Quran. You're basing yourself on the word low?
Why not? It's right
the because the word low is used similarly in plenty of other places in Chumash. It's Hebrew. It's I think you're being over harsh on the Gemara here. For example, lo yelacha b'chischa even va'aven, right? It's the same structure. I'm not so sure that your read is right.
Well, I can prove that my read is right because otherwise there would be no need for any musical note under lo. You could just read musical note under rut and susim and nothing in between. But the other issue is, like, honestly, the problem here is that Talmidei Chachamim forget to go to movies. Okay? I'm serious. Okay? If anybody who's gone to Ben-Hur or any other movie like that knows that some chariots are with one horse, and some chariots are with four horses for various different reasons. Mm-hmm. And here you don't even have four to one. So it's not a problem.
Got it.
If you want to figure it out, seriously.
Okay, I hear you. I hear you. it's a valid point, and Ben-Hur was in chapter 4, so that fits. Okay, other questions and comments? I'll take the latter one, Moish, not the first one.
Okay. You're just changing the Torah, but that's okay.
So,
I mean, Trump has a reason.
In terms of, yeah, but not that reason, that's all. But in terms of Shlomo's general approach and his approach in terms of the wives he's going to have and amassing silver and gold, as we're going to see, this point about the horses is just very consistent. It fits into Shlomo's general pattern of just, you know, a living large type of approach. All right. So that brings us to the next part of chapter 5. And this part, you know, part of me wanted to just say, let's go through this part really quickly because it's going to be, it's not of great importance for the rest of the story. On the other hand, who in the world learns about Solomon without learning about the wisdom of Solomon? Like, how could we just run through the description of his wisdom? So we are going to take some time on this. It'll end up running into next time, I think, fairly clearly. This section tells us that the wisdom Shlomo received in chapter 3 will serve the goal of increasing the stature of the Jewish kingdom in the greater world. In chapter 3, we didn't find out what exactly was included in that wisdom. It shows up over here. Abarbanel suggests why it waits to be over here. If you take a look at source number 10, he says, Lahodienu, this is here in order to inform us, She'im heyos shehir balo susim uparashim, even though he had lots of horses and charioteers, va'anshei beisu, he's got a lot of people, lo nimna mipneze mehishakim, l'v'isha etzachoch maso al derech hapele. Nonetheless, he still became wise. He still managed to develop great wisdom because his wisdom came from Hashem. As we saw, Barbanel believes that the wisdom came from Hashem just injecting it into him. It wasn't that he had to sit in a library poring over books or debate things with sages. It just came to him. And therefore, you're looking at all this wealth and thinking to yourself, how wise could he have been? Now you're going to find out just how much wisdom he had. That's a Barbanel's read for why this is here in chapter 5 instead of chapter 3. I would argue, and I think it's consistent with a point that Malbim makes in source number 11, that the reason this is here is to illustrate what Shlomo achieved with the wisdom he was given. Chapter 3 was, I'm giving you wisdom. Chapter 5 is what Shlomo did with it. Malbim says, first we talked about his administrative wisdom, that, you know, he had the 12 officers and the scribes and all that. And now we're going to find out what he did when Hashem gave him wisdom and very great understanding. We'll see he wrote books and he learned about this and he learned about that. So that's what this section is about. This is execution. Chapter 3 was potential and chapter 5 is reality. That to me is what's going on here. Yes, Susan.
You beautiful or good looking, whatever your gift may be.
Right.
It's a lesson that, okay, you've got the gift. That's not what's important. What's important is what you do with the gift, how you treat it with other people, how you behave as a human being. Because I think that's the lesson here.
In terms of, like, how do you see that here?
Well, just what you said. Here, Shlomo was given the wisdom.
Right.
Okay, he could have used it for wrath.
Mm.
But he used it in a way, they're showing us what you can do with the gift God has given.
Right. I hear that.
Be a better person. And I think that's the lesson here, because people take their gifts for granted.
Mm. It's a valid point for sure. Unfortunately, we're going to find out, not this week, but eventually, that it doesn't always get used in a good way. That's part of the lesson of Shlomo's story. But I hear you for sure. So let's see what happens. Sentence 9. Vayitein Elokim chokhma l'Shlomo usvuna harbe me'od. Hashem gives Shlomo wisdom, chokhma. I'm translating, as I said to you when we did chapter 3, I'm not doing a lot of distinguishing between chokhma and bina and das and all of that. Can't do it. Ellen, that was your point? He has chokhma, which I, again, just keep saying wisdom for, and tivuna, which is usually understanding, harbe me'od, an awful lot of it. If you're interested, you should take a look at Malbim here. He has a discussion of chokhma and tivuna and rochav lev, but I'm not going there. V'rochav lev, he has breath of heart, that's the line, kachol asher al sfas hayam, like sand at the shore of the sea. So, a few notes here. First of all, in the next psukim, in the next sentences, we're going to see that specifically he has knowledge in what seems to be the area of natural sciences. That's going to show up in sentence 13. In sentence 12, we're going to talk about him having parables, which sounds like he's teaching people philosophical ideas and lessons in character, as we'll see. It's also going to talk about him being wiser than the people of the East and of Egypt, introducing the idea that maybe we're talking about more arcane fields of wisdom, that was associated with Egypt and the East. And then one other note, and so we did make it to this today, Susan, the Gemara in Gittin, in source number 12. This is tip of the iceberg, but I wasn't going to let it go without mentioning it. There is a verse in Kohelet, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and that's what this passage in the Gemara begins with, in which, remember, Shlomo is credited with authorship of Kohelet. So Shlomo says, Asisi li, I made for myself, sharim visharot, which sounds like male and female singers. Don't ask me the kol isha question, is Shlomo listening to women singing? The commentators all have various ways to explain this without Shlomo listening to women singing. Don't get excited. I made for myself male and female singers, v'tanu gos b'nei adam, and the pleasures of people, shida v'shidot. And that's our focus here. Shida and shidot. So sharim v'sharot, that's easy. Elu minei zemer. These are kinds of music. Fine. I'm skipping them. Tanugot b'nei adam, the pleasures of man. Elu brechot u'merchatzaot. That's pools and bathhouses. Shida v'shidot. What does that mean? So hacha targimu, here, meaning in Babylon, they explained, sheda v'shedetin, male and female demons. Shlomo has control over, knowledge of and control over demons. B'marava, in Israel, Amri Shedita. They said, no. If you're familiar at all with the Gemara's terms for receptacles, large receptacles, you have a set of three different words that are used a lot. Shida, Teva, and Migdal. They refer to different kinds of receptacles for storing very large amounts. So that's what this is. It's a Shida like that, they said in Israel. It means, Shlomo said, I have big storage containers. along with my pools and bathhouses. Why is he glorifying himself that he had storage containers? I don't know. Was Shlomo a hoarder? It's going to sound like that at one point. We've got all these horses. But in terms of the demon's idea, so I couldn't, you know, not mention this idea. And Susan was asking me about the whole demonology in the Gemara before. There's a lot of debate as to how to understand the Gemara's references to demons. The Gemara really does seem to believe that these exist. On the other hand, Maimonides, as he is often explained by various writers, says there are no such thing. There is no such thing as demons. There's a line attributed to the Rugachever. The Rugachever was one of the most brilliant writers of in all of Jewish writerdom. One of the biggest of the Chachamim, just out of this world. And so there's a comment attributed to him that that when the Rambam said there are no demons, demons cease to exist. He paskin, there are no demons. They said, oops, and that was it. They stopped existing. But the Gemara clearly believes that there is such a thing as a creature Hashem created that you can't see and that is able to have an impact nonetheless on your life. I remember hearing Rav Aaron Soloveitchik say many, many years ago, I was still in high school, but I remember hearing Rav Aaron Soloveitchik say that, that Shadim could be viruses. He suggested viruses. The problem with that idea, and of course we've been living with this for the last couple of years, our own personal shadim, but the problem with it is that there are places in the Gemara where they are attributed with physical characteristics as well as speech. As far as I know, viruses don't speak. They may cause somebody to hallucinate, but they don't speak. But also there's the classic is the beginning of Brachos where they talk about detecting a shade by putting out ashes on the ground, and the shade, you'll find the shade's footprints in the ashes. So viruses, as far as I know, don't leave footprints. So that's a little bit difficult. The most intriguing explanation I've ever seen for shadim, and I don't know what it means, but it's fascinating, was from Rav Yitzchak Huttner. Rav Yitzchak Huttner is best known for his Pachad Yitzchak set of svarim, of books. He also had journals that he kept. And in one of his journals, he suggested the following. There is a Gemara that suggests, either Gemara or it's a Medrash in Avos Rabbi Nassan, I forget where, which says that everything that exists in the human being is a microcosm of something that exists in the universe as a whole. All aspects of a human being exist in the universe as a whole. And he said, the human imagination is reflected in Shadim. That was his idea. The human imagination is reflected in Shadim. I don't really know what that means, and I've thought about it for a while. I posted it online at one point. Maybe if I get a chance, I'll send you the link, or I'll include it in next week's source sheet. I don't know if he's saying they're imaginary, or if he's saying, I don't know. I don't know what he means by saying that, but I think it's an interesting thing. Okay. Whatever it is, Shlomo has control of that too. That's the idea. And what I'm actually more intrigued about than the demons is the description of his wisdom as being like the sand at the shore of the sea. Without looking ahead on the source sheet, what does that mean? Like the sand at the shore of the sea. What is that reference? What would you say? I'm sorry, I need you to speak louder. There's noise in the hallway outside my room.
Sorry, you can't quantify it.
Ah, so one way to look at it is to say it's immeasurable. That's Radak's view. Radak says it means beyond measure, just like for us. We are supposed to be like the sand at the sea. Asher lo yimad v'lo yisafer. It can't be measured, it can't be counted. That's one view for sure. Joyce, you unmuted. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, God promised Abraham the same wish.
Good. So one approach to this Well, let me actually build on that. Moshe, I see your hand, but now I'm going to go ahead with what Joyce just said, and I can come back to you, hopefully, after that. If you take a look at source number 13, thanks, there's a Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah. This Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah ignores the fact that we use this sand at the sea for the Jewish people, and just offers the following. Mau kechol, what does that mean when it says that his wisdom is like sand? Rabbanan Amri, Nasan lo chochma kineged kol Yisrael, our sages said, God gave him wisdom parallel to all Israel. That's like what Joyce said. Shneamar vayim mispar b'nei Yisrael kechol hayam, like the Pasuk says. So that's one view, and then you get Rabbi Levi with a completely different view. Amar Rabbi Levi, ma chol geder liyam, just like the sand is a fence for the sea, kach haisa chochma gedura lishlomo. So too was wisdom was gedura for Shlomo. It was a fence for Shlomo. Masla amrin, and they give a parable. Dea chasart makonit, dea kanita machasarta. I thank you for posting in the chat. Moshe posted my pasuk that I was trying to remember about Aza. The pasuk in Mishlei, Shlomo's pasuk, says, if you are lacking wisdom, what have you acquired? I put my quotation marks in incorrectly. Sorry, this is not the part from Mishlei. This is a parable first that says, if you are lacking wisdom, what have you acquired? If you have acquired wisdom, what do you lack? Wisdom will protect all that you acquire. And then they give you Mishlei, Shlomo's parable, in which he says, Ir prutza ein choma, ish ein matzor lerucho. A person who has no restraint on his desires is like a city that is wide open, that is exposed, that has no wall. In other words, you need something to bound you, and Shlomo's wisdom was his boundary. It was like the sand as the boundary at the sea. Until the sea rises and erodes it and whatever. But that's the idea. So this Medrash, Rabbi Levi, in this Medrash, says that it has nothing to do with the connection with the Jews. It has to do with, in general, a statement. His wisdom was like the sand bounding the sea. However, others do indeed see a link between Shlomo's wisdom being like the sand and the Jews being like the sand. And I bulleted it for you in source number 14. I just did it as a list. First, as Ricky suggested, Radak says it means it's immeasurable. Just like we are supposed to be immeasurable, Shlomo's wisdom is immeasurable. The Medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah, the first approach there, said he is as wise as all Israel. Right? That was the first view that we saw there in the Medrash, that he is as wise as all Israel. I would suggest, though, an additional idea. Go back to chapter 3, sentences 8 and 9, please, when Shlomo asked for wisdom. Shlomo's request, right, you see it? He says, I am in the middle of this nation you chose, a great nation which is innumerable. God, give me a listening heart to be able to judge them, to understand between good and bad. Who could judge this heavy nation? And we gave all these different explanations for the different phrases. I'm not going back to that right now. My point is that Shlomo asked Hashem for the wisdom to be able to deal with all of Israel. Now, what we're saying is he got his wish. Hashem gave him wisdom like the sand at the sea, like Israel. You got what you asked for, is what I'm seeing here in the use of that phrase. You wanted to have the wisdom to deal with all Israel, now that's exactly what you got. Moshe, what were you going to say?
Just hold on a second.
Okay.
There we go. Okay. I'd like to offer a thought on what you said about 5 minutes ago regarding the shade, and also that will relate to what you said before about I'll call you above or something. I think that the notion here is that for
Shlomo, there's a point at which his mind reaches not a finite, but a metaphysical, possible stop point. Mm-hmm. Where his mind says, stop here, you can't go beyond here, and that's the shade point. And Shlomo went beyond that point, and what God said is, Kol Yamecha, or whatever the word is, if you keep going, that shade will be there forever. If you learn that there is a point that you can't go beyond, then the shade will be removed. And that's really the shade as you're describing it. And it's in his own mind. But the thing is, it's in his own mind. He doesn't know whether somebody is telling him that, or psychologically he's afraid of a barrier.
So it's an interesting idea, Moshe. It actually is an interesting idea also in light of the Gemara and Gittin, because you know that the passage I quoted there leads into a discussion we're not ready for yet. We have to come back to in chapter 11 about Shlomo at one point being dethroned by a demon. So, yeah. So I hear what you're saying, but we're not there yet. That has to wait for chapter 11 in order for us to reach it. Okay. So what we see is that Shlomo has great wisdom, and then we're told it's greater than Kedem and Egypt. So what is the knowledge of Kedem and Egypt? I already told you I thought it might be arcane knowledge. So first of all, who in the world are Kedem? Well, Radak and Ralbag believe it means people of the East who were known for wisdom. And they quote Yeshaya chapter 2 with a verse that could be linked to that. Abarbanel says, no, that's not what Kedem means. Kedem means grape juice. No, he says Kedem means before. Kodem. Kedem means before. He says it means the earliest people. Abarbanel writes, and I didn't bring it for you here on the sheet. There's too much else to bring. But he says, when you go back to the beginning of the Chumash, and people live super long lives, they have so much time, they can develop an incredible resource of wisdom. And Shlomo has more wisdom than those people from ancient times. That's what Abarbanel believes is what this is, is who the B'nai Kedem are. But in terms of what their wisdom and knowledge is, that's what we're going to have to start with next time. And God willing, next time we will see an awful lot about Shlomo's wisdom before hopefully starting on the partnership with King Hiram of Tzor that enables him to construct the Beis HaMikdash. So there's a lot to be said here. Special note for Moshe, you really want to look at source number 17. It's going to make you a very happy man. So we'll get to that, God willing, next week. And again, I hope people are able to make it tonight for the special shiur. If you can't, I understand. But that'll be it.
Your real birthday.
Sorry?
Two more days for your real birthday.
Yes, that's correct. Wednesday night, Thursday. Okay, thank you very much.